Our first reading this morning is from the Reverend Marta Valentin, who identifies herself as a Latina and who was ordained minister in 2003. The reading we are trying to tell you comes from The Arc of the Universe is Long.
People of color have been trying to tell UUs how to keep us here. Do you hear us? Are you listening? It seems we're using the same words, but not speaking the same language. We are telling you that your desire to create a multicultural community is fabulous, but requires that you make room for us in your head, in your heart, in the room, and at the table. It requires that you be willing to grow and transform. It requires that you be willing to share a meal with me of what I like to eat, because I eat your food all the time. Better yet, it requires that you invite me to your house for dinner. It doesn't matter what food we eat, mine or yours, only that you invite me into your space. People of color have been trying to tell UUs how to keep us here for decades. We are trying to tell you that all your good efforts, without doing the analysis, have only served to maintain the status quo. Do you hear us? Are you listening? And when you bring us in without doing the work of the analysis, all you accomplish is status color. And you wonder why this multicultural world you're trying to build isn't working, manifesting, colorizing. It reminds me of those rainbow-colored plastic sheets we used to use to put on the TV before a real color TV came along. Do you hear us when we tell you that we take our seven principles seriously? They are our system of accountability to the interdependent web of all humanity and sentient beings. If it were up to us, we would make the last principle our first. For how we are connected to each other is far more important than who we are as individuals. There, I said it. I went against our individualistic suit of armor to acknowledge that we are socialized into group identities. The people of color in the UU world are offering a new language to create a new world. But you must get out of your individualistic heads and feel us. Feel that what we bring is more than words. Feel that what we bring is more than trouble. Understand and accept that we bring a multitude of opportunities to create a multicultural world that has yet to be lived. We bring the delicious diversity that so many crave. We bring a notion of a world that is truly equal. We bring you to you in unimaginable ways that we've only had inklings of so far. And when you hear us, when you listen, when you feel us, you bring us to us. The people of color are trying to tell UUs that all love is the same, but it must be expressed truthfully.
Our second reading you can follow along with on the back of your order of celebration at the bottom. It's our very own mission statement adopted this year. It goes, "We are here to learn and practice true hospitality, to revere the reasoning mind and the generous heart, to claim our diversity as a source of our strength, and to relinquish the safety of our unexamined privilege for the freedom to engage in transforming justice."
Thank you. My name is Marissa Kaloga. My husband and I met when we were both in college in Michigan. He was an international student from West Africa, and I was just out of high school. He was learning English, and I was learning French. We thought it would just be one date, but after a week of seeing one another every day, we both knew it was more. Over the next few years, we were together as much as possible, but being a young college student, I wanted to move around a bit. So after stints in New York and Toronto while he stayed in Michigan, we moved to Columbus. Soon after, we were married in the Rose Garden by Reverend Bellatini and moved into a tiny apartment in German Village. It would be a lie to say that our relationship is like any other. We have significant challenges. You see, Thibaut is black and I am white. He is Francophone and I am Anglophone. He is Guinean and I am an American. He is a Muslim and I was raised Christian. It was most likely this challenge and the utopian potential of the relationship that initially drew me to him. But life is all in the details. There is a lot of talk about getting along with everyone, all well and good for coworkers or classmates or neighbors. But in the trenches of family life, cultural differences can be an abyss. Because of my deep and abiding love for him, it has been a quest for me to look outside of myself, to understand the world from his point of view, to see things through his lens. It is in large part because of this that I chose to study international development, French, and African history. Through scholarly self-development, I was able to detach my cultural baggage, so to speak, and work out a framework whereby I could really understand where he was coming from and learn from it. Several years after we were married, I was blessed with twin boys, Adam Raphael and Mahmoud Amelio Kaloga, the two-year-olds Adam and Leo that you see running around the church. I was also blessed with the addition of my mother-in-law, Mika, to our household. After having spent 25 years in Africa, she arrived in the United States as a Cuban refugee shortly before I became pregnant. With these additions, our family has become increasingly complex. We are now a small United Nations trying as peaceably as possible to live in a home with three countries, three generations, and three languages. And surprisingly, it's going pretty well. My children are small now, and family life is new. Although there is a struggle that comes with growing a family, I am sure that these will be some of the happiest times of our lives. But as I look towards a bright future for us all, there are questions that I anticipate I will need to answer for my children. One of them is, who am I? Who are they? Adam is named for his great-grandmother, Adama, a mother of 10 from the Tukulars in Dingirai, followers of Alhaj Omar Tal, a people of many ethnicities living together under a religious commonality. Adam Raphael is named for his great-grandfather, who came to Cuba from Spain with his family, only to find heartache by marrying a beautiful mulatta woman who his family would not accept. Mahmoud is named for his grandfather, who went to Cuba to get a master's degree and came back with a Catholic mulatta as his wife, much to his Muslim family's chagrin. Mahmoud Amelio is named for his great-grandmother, Amelia, a mother of 10 who married a dashing Spanish immigrant whose family would eventually convince him to leave her and return to Spain. From this, I would ascertain that my children, at least as far as their namesakes, are destined to fall in love with someone outside of their culture and have many, many children. Of course, depending on where they're living, their identities would be very different. Take their race, for example. In America, they're multiracial or mixed or just black. Black and white together. But in Havana, Cuba, there are many more descriptors. What we would consider mixed could be described as mulatto, moro, indio, jaba, depending on their physical characteristics. In Guinea, people are more likely described by their ethnicity, with those underlying physical characteristics such as a fula, a susu, a malinke, a Bambara. Of course, I've been told that in Guinea, they'll just be called white. It's a hard question. Who are you, my children? One that I hope will be easier for them now that we live in an increasingly global society. It is my hope that their multiracial, multi-ethnic, trilingual selves will find these descriptives a blessing and not a burden. It is my hope that their navigation of several cultures in one family will serve to teach them about navigation of relationships in other contexts. But of course, there will be bad days. Those days when they are asked to sum up their identities in a single word and fail to do so. Those days when an immigrant father's dreams for his children seem too big for them to handle. Those days when we want the whole family to be together for the holidays, but we are continents apart. Because for all the joy that we find in discovering their unfolding identity as a family unit, there are many obstacles to face. We live in a world that can be very unlike our broad-minded family. It is up to me, as mother of my flock, to find within this complicated world the communities and experiences necessary to shape within my children an admiration of their amazing lineage and a confidence in themselves. Just imagine the thousands of twists of fate that led my sons Adam and Leo to be born. Take a snapshot in time. In the mid-1800s, they had ancestors in West Africa following El Hajj Omar Tal to war against the colonizers. They had ancestors in Cuba participating in successful armed slave uprisings. They had Irish ancestors scrambling onto ships to escape the potato famine. And they had American ancestors watching their country slide into civil war. And from these desperate circumstances, somehow, a young African student made it to Lansing, Michigan, just in time to pass a young American student in the hallway, and had just enough courage to say, "Hello." So that is my family, a family that I am very proud to call my own. For any additional difficulties that we face, I would never have it any other way. And the community that I spoke of, to nurture my two young souls and give them confidence in a world outside the protection of their watchful parents, I hope to find that here among you. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Carrie McDonald, and I feel blessed to have grown up in the Unitarian Universalist Church. Being biracial in a majority white denomination didn't particularly faze me, as there aren't a lot of places where being biracial puts you in the majority. But this church does a wonderful job of teaching issues of race, class, and privilege to its youth, and I was the lucky recipient of that careful and loving dialogue. When we did anti-racism trainings and workshops, especially those that involved breaking into discussion groups by ethnicity that were comically disproportionate, I had the unique freedom to witness intra-racial interaction from both sides of the glass. I could be a fly on the wall to see my white peers talk to each other about how to be a good racial ally, and also chat with my peers of color about the identity questions we all faced. By the time I reached college, I had a pretty fluent, if still young, understanding about race in middle and upper middle class America. Cut to freshman orientation when I was at an expensive liberal arts college in California, where the dean of students was talking to us about sensitivity to systems of oppression. It didn't feel particularly out of place to me, though I hadn't been exposed to that kind of academic vocabulary yet. But the reactions of my fellow students were dramatic and stark in their division. Some were awestruck by the revelation that there could be such pervasive forces at work in our society about which no one had ever talked to them, and became fascinated by the topic and joined what I later called the leftist establishment on campus. Others, also surprised by the depth of what they were hearing, were defensive and indignant and felt personally blamed for the fact that there could be such pervasive forces at work in our society about which no one had ever talked to them. I empathized with both of these perspectives, but at first I assumed there would still have to be a reckoning. When all the cards were laid on the table, wouldn't someone have to admit they overreacted or got these issues confused with their own issues of identity and acceptance? No, there is no answer in the balance, I eventually decided. A professor of mine once pointed out that two things which were mutually exclusive could be true at the same time. And that's more or less how I feel about issues of critical social importance, including race. Listening to a queer studies major tell me that they were hyper-conscious of a heteronormative social paradigm, you've really got to love this vocabulary. You know, I felt that was totally valid. And I also thought that the dude from Seattle, who'd always considered himself pretty liberal and felt blindsided by a lot of talk about a privilege that he didn't ask for, was coming from an honest place and was worthy of affirmation. In fact, I think this is the problem with the considerations we attempt in America about race and class and gender. There's just too much truth to be constrained by one experience or point of view. It has to be a yes-both situation, not either-or. By the way, Obama's speech on race in Philadelphia of March 2008 makes this point better than I ever could, and if you haven't read it at least five times already, there's plenty of time this afternoon to do so. So this is hard stuff. Americans have a harder time communicating about race than any other issue. Ask a parent to give their middle schooler the talk, but make it about race, and they will beg to lecture on sex. This is hard because we don't have a national language in which to converse about it. We have only the words inherited from our predecessors, which are products of their time rather than ours, or the vocabulary used by academics, which doesn't make sense if you don't know how to interpret it. People can be deeply hurt by misunderstandings that arise from imprecise speech, which is why I can't tell you how many times I've been involved in discussions on race that devolve into debates on definitions. Personally, I feel that the word privilege, for example, which we use to describe ways in which societal forces are not prejudiced against our individual identities, conveys the wrong message that somehow everyone isn't entitled to that kind of acceptance. But we don't call it disadvantage because we don't want to blame the victims. Mostly, however, this is hard because it's really important, but we lack the framework with which to fit it into our humanity. To return to the beginning of my statement here, I feel really blessed to have grown up in the Unitarian Universalist Church because, at least among youth, we have figured out how to incorporate our knowledge about systems of oppression into our daily lives, and I think that that's the key. We retreat to our ideological corners, we throw up defensive walls, and we conflate issues to be able to claim the moral imperative whenever race comes up. In times of confusion, I try to step back and think about what my goal is so I can keep my eye on the ball. And the ball, in this case, isn't a racial identity-free society. That sounds boring. And it isn't a racism-free society. That's unrealistic. The ball, in this case, is understanding how these forces work within and around us so that we can incorporate that into our everyday understanding of the world and better grow and live spiritual lives of love and compassion and justice in it. We talk about this stuff so that it can be internalized, not obsessed over and infinitely debated, because for me, and I believe for most people, a full life is about the love within it, not the societal structures that surround it. In that spirit, today I challenge us all to be open to ourselves and to honest communication about race in our community, and to believe that everyone else is being truthful too, because there is no way to discuss these issues if there is a vast gulf of distrust between the participants. We have to forsake the soapboxes and the shadows to see it, but a finer understanding of these difficult issues is a prerequisite to being open and honest with the world. And then, when we find a cadence, recognizing that this is a lifelong journey of self-discovery and affirmation of others, we'll be able to talk about everything else. Thank you.
My name is Vina Brannon. As I reflect on the title of today's service, being part of a chocolate chip cookie church, I realize that this metaphor of the chocolate chip cookie is incredibly appropriate to my life. I was born Veena Gopalakrishna to an Indian father and a white mother in an affluent suburb of Cleveland. My father came to the United States during a time when he believed survival meant assimilation. He stopped going to temple. He started eating meat. He thought he curtailed his accent, and he married for love. My parents never much talked about the challenges they encountered as a biracial couple, and they would not entertain the notion of us children thinking we were any different than the next family. I was raised without thinking much of my biracial status. I just had this feeling of being out of place. I would be reminded of this status, however, every time someone would ask, "So where are you from?" I would slyly answer, "Cleveland?" "No, where are you really from?" Defiantly, I answer, "A suburb of Cleveland." I knew that this stranger really wanted to ask, "What is your race? What is your ethnicity? You're not white. There's something else there, but I just can't put my finger on it." Several months ago, I listened to Ray and Lori's daughter, Sammy, discuss her coming-of-age philosophy on faith. I was so excited to learn that this family had kids from an Indian father and a white mother. Their family is the only other family that I've ever met that is like mine. I wanted to run to these children. I wanted to ask them about growing up today. Did they struggle with their biracial status? I wanted to tell them that when I was in the first grade, my best friend slapped away my hand as I tried to steal a French fry from her plate. She explained to me that my hand was dirty. It must be. It's brown. I wanted to tell them about the time I was lifeguarding and a little Indian girl who was always swimming was not in her bathing suit. She was fully clothed. And when I asked her why, she said she couldn't get any more tan because school was starting soon, and she couldn't have her friends, the other kids, make fun of her dark skin. I wanted to tell the Nandyal children about my little brother who played with me and my friends growing up because he had no friends in the neighborhood because he was the brown boy. I didn't approach the Nandyal children that day because I wasn't sure how. I wasn't sure how to explain that the world around me has always been white with a few chocolate chips sprinkled inside. I wasn't sure how to make sense of the fact that for most of my life, I have felt like a lone pecan thrown into that cookie. I wasn't sure how my excitement at meeting these children would come across. I figured it could go one of two ways. Either I would be seen as a person of color trying to relate to another, or as a complete weirdo, and Ray and Lori would take their children running away from me. I opted for silence that day. I opted to avoid the encounter. I opted for avoidance. Today, my partner and I raised two boys, Kaviraj and Jayan, who are one quarter Indian, one quarter African American, and the rest Irish, German, and English. My white partner and I decided to use an anonymous donor who identifies as half African American and half Irish German. We struggled with this decision. We fell in love with this guy the moment we read the profile. The kind of guy I'd like to take home to mom. His grandmother was an animal rights activist. His mother, a fellow UU. What was not to love? The reason we struggled is because we automatically were going to bring children into this world in a same-sex household. Were we really going to add this racial complexity to the mix as well? The part that made me so angry, so frustrated, is that we even had to have this discussion to begin with. My family, in many ways, represents diversity. We came to this church because we are more than tolerated. We are honored. We are made to feel more than welcomed. We are needed. I want us to honor all multiracial persons, letting everyone know that the faces, the voices, the experiences of a racially diverse congregation are more than welcomed. They are needed. All viewpoints cannot fully be represented or understood without this beautiful mixture of people. The richness of our lives cannot fully be realized without this. And as my boys grow up in this church, I want them to be able to look into the eyes of its members and know that each of us is willing to step up to the counter to bake the perfect cookie. This is not possible if ingredients are missing from the counter. Although I opted to avoid learning from the Nandiel children that day, I know, and it is my hope for this church, that not one of us opts to avoid the counter. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Julie Henderson, and as you can see, I've never been much of a chocolate chip. I'm more of the doughy beige part of the cookie. However, 5 years ago, my husband Lou, our biological daughter Rowan, and I became a multiracial family through adoption. At that time, we welcomed the then 2-year-old Fatima into our family from Liberia, West Africa. During the adoption process, there were many discussions between Lou and I and in our adoption classes about the potential issues in interracial and cross-cultural adoption. We read some books like I'm Chocolate, You're Vanilla, Raising Healthy Black and Biracial Children in a Race-Conscious World. We tried to anticipate what difficulties we might face and how we might best preserve our child's cultural heritage. We decided we were up to that challenge. After all, we thought we were pretty smart and sensitive and politically correct. It's very interesting now to look back on that time. I think it's fair to say that we were somehow both naive and overly concerned all at the same time. In all honesty, I would say that our biggest adjustments were with more global issues related to family, siblings, adding another child, and just accommodating different personalities rather than to issues of race. There were some racial issues we had to deal with right off the bat, such as the fact that for the first year or so that she was here, Tima refused to speak or really even look at any African-American adult. That was really uncomfortable for us. We felt embarrassed and afraid that we would be judged. However, people seemed to understand that it was just part of the process, and we rarely encountered any of the judgment we anticipated. When Rowan, our oldest, started kindergarten and Tima was just a toddler, there were at first the mystified reactions of Rowan's classmates. Is that your sister? She's black. Tima really hated that. But by and large, we were so busy adjusting as a family for the first 2 years or so that issues of race took a back seat to doing the work necessary and becoming a family. We worried when she talked of wishing that she had hair like Rowan's or that she was white. We were both worried and relieved when she seemed to make her own kind of peace with our family's skin tones by deciding that Rowan and I, the pale blondes, were white, while that she and Lou, with his more olive skin and dark hair, were brown. One recommendation that we found in the adoption literature and in our classes was the notion that families should find communities of people that are reflective of the adopted child's race. We are fortunate to live in a racially diverse neighborhood. The family behind us was black, and our girls played together constantly. Our library, our rec center, all these places, Tima could look around and see faces that reflected her own. When Rowan started school, her Columbus City school was very diverse, not only with African-American students, but many African immigrant families. 2 years ago, Tima followed her to the same school. Again, the questions. Is that your mom? Is that your sister? They're white. Tima seems inured to those questions now and just says, yes, I know. I admit that I was a bit taken aback last year when I went to visit her kindergarten classroom and discovered that all her little friends I'd heard her talk about were white. Immediately in my head, I thought, oh no, we have not done right by her. She only likes white kids. She can't stand herself. She's ashamed of her color. I tend to go towards the dramatic a little bit. But time and more observation have shown me that she does indeed have lots of little black friends and seems pretty comfortable in her own skin. Her attraction to certain friends seems far more based on a shared sense of orneriness and hence sense of humor than on skin color. So that leaves our first UU community here. Many times in our adoption process, we heard or read that white families who adopt black children should find at least a well-integrated church, if not a black church, to attend for the sake of their child's development and self-esteem. We decided that for us, there were some things that outweighed the race issue. We joined First UU, despite its somewhat underwhelming minority statistics, because we felt that what our children would learn here, tolerance, understanding, respect for others and their beliefs, carried at least as much importance as the need for diversity in our surroundings. Perhaps if there had been another UU church in town with a more diverse congregation, we would have gone there. But for our family, the teachings of Unitarian Universalism were what we felt was the most important factor. I am happy to say that we still think we've made the right choice. This community has been loving and accepting of our family and of Tima. We've not felt like we were unusual, nor made to feel like our daughter was a token to be trotted out. Even more encouraging is what our girls have had to say about all of this. When we talked with them, both of them were quick to say that they are never made to feel uncomfortable, nor has anyone ever been mean to them or even asked them uncomfortable questions. They feel totally welcomed and accepted for who they are. Tima is aware that there aren't many other kids of her skin color, but says that she doesn't really feel that different. It would be nice to have some more brown kids, but she kind of likes being unique as well, she said. Rowan pointed out that there is somewhat more racial variety among the kids than we see here in the worship center among the adults. She felt, however, and I quote, that it would be nice to have more different kinds of people in our church because our church is supposed to be about accepting differences, and it would prove that we really mean what we say. We should look like what we say we are, end quote. I see our family as a microcosm of this church. Lou and I, we have good intentions, but we probably haven't done quite as much as we should have or could have to incorporate diverse activities and communities into our family life. But our hearts and our minds are open, and we're working hard to be a close and loving family. Our children and the children here at First UU give us hope for what the future can look like. As time goes on, our family will add more diversity into our family life, and we hope that that can happen here at First UU as well.
Good morning. My name is Ray Nandial. As a member of this church, I have been on a few committees and the board. My greatest privilege was serving as co-chair of the Same-Sex Marriage Task Force, which brought the gross inequalities of the legal system to our community's attention. Well, after a period of such intense activity, I stopped darkening the doors of this church. I call this the phenomenon of the reverse lightning bugs. Reverse lightning bugs are people of color who visit predominantly white churches, even become active members, frantically flash our darkness about, and then disappear. Why do we do that? Here's my story. Being a perpetual visible minority is inherently disempowering and not much fun. For instance, one becomes a curiosity piece for new members and visitors whose stares seem to indicate that even a visitor, because of his or her whiteness, instantly belongs, whereas I, with over a decade of membership and service, still stick out like a sore thumb. But what got to me most were the explanations from other members that the overwhelming whiteness of our church is merely an accident, or worse, the result of them not liking our style of worship and our intellectual approach to faith. Once we shifted the responsibility to them, race becomes the habitually ignored elephant in the living room. While some UU churches made racial reconciliation their highest priority, the word race was excluded from our mission and vision statements until 4 months ago. Whether that is a coincidence or not, I have felt that our church, wonderful as it is in other respects, never made the intentional commitment to racial reconciliation. It was simply not a high priority. It's important to distinguish here between merely tolerating the presence of those who look different and actively willing a racially harmonious congregation and community into existence. We have plenty of toleration. What is needed is a strong will to change ourselves in fundamental ways so that we could achieve not just assimilation, but true integration. The necessary change involves integrating not only our hearts and minds, but our dinner tables and our friendships. Once that happens, facts like 1/3 of all African-American men under 30 being in prison and racial disparity of access to education, employment, transportation, healthcare, and law and justice no longer remain statistics, but become a heartfelt passion for progress and reform. Without this transformation of our inner selves, adding another dozen or two people of color would just be a window dressing. Please note that this transformation is not an impossible task. Other UU churches, such as All Souls in Washington, D.C., Davies Memorial UU at Camp Springs, Maryland, and UU Society East of Manchester, Connecticut, are embarking on similar journeys. Our church's new mission and vision statements are an excellent start and serve as a roadmap to where we need to be as members of this great church and as citizens of this great nation. These statements are our declaration of racial interdependence. We will not reduce polarization and create unity overnight, but we surely can chip away at it every day. This June, our congregation formed a racial diversity task force whose mission is to intensely engage our church with the community of Columbus. We have started facilitating honest conversations, creating coalitions, and offering opportunities for our members to work hand in hand with our brothers and sisters of color. But the task force is not going to do our work for us. We have to make it a priority to reach out to our neighbors who may not look like us and expand the community of peace with each handshake and caring words and actions. Of course, we don't do this just to make ourselves feel good. We do it because it lets us practice what we preach. This is the heart of Unitarian Universalism. We will be able to speak of the interconnectedness of the universe with conviction when we have worked our behinds off on the interconnectedness of Columbus, Ohio. My own sense of interconnectedness goes deeper. Until all loving couples, irrespective of sexual orientation, are treated equally under the law, I do not consider my straight marriage complete. And until all children, no matter what their race, get equal access to education, my beautiful biracial children's education will be deficient. This is my story, This is my life. And until the last flutter of my wings, this reverse lightning bug will continue this work and spread this message. Namaste.
During the abolitionist movement, Unitarians and Universalists were active in attempting to abolish slavery. During the Civil Rights Movement, Unitarian Universalists, now bound together in one association, worked in the Civil Rights Movement. And the Reverend James Reeb, a minister in the denomination, and Viola Liozzo, a working class mother from Detroit, died in that struggle. Yet historically, we have remained largely a one-race denomination. Our diversity has come in other ways. We are a denomination that welcomes theists, deists, humanists, Christians, pagans, and free thinkers of all sorts. Our direction comes not from a pope or a bishop or any central headquarters. We are a congregational church. We bind ourselves together by agreeing to abide by a certain set of principles that will guide our conduct in the world and within our community. We express our diversity in that way.